real six. You were at North Brunswick just a short time, and of course your training obviously was widening in its in a sense. Was this the first time that you were introduced to the mortars at North Brunswick, New Brunswick?
Yes.
What mortars were you introduced to?
The only one we used was the one we tried before, the Swedish mortar.
What
happened was, as I said, the people were designated for movement to go to signals in the Swedish mortars. And we only used the Swedish.
Or was that a section weapon?
That was a section weapon.
How did it function?
It was actually a platoon mortar. In platoon headquarters, you had the platoon commander describing the Swedish mortar. And the company running.
How did it function, the 2-inch mortar? Or how did you fire it, in effect?
The fire, well, it consisted of a base plate and a small tank. The line on the base plate would be chest. The striking was two turbos, one for aviation, horizontal aviation. The range finder was on the side. I think we got to find it. I don't know. The 2-inch trench mortar that had a muscle cover on the top of the boat, a little cool protector. Then we're on the side with a 15 more. But on the straight bracket and the bottom deck, elevation to the edge, elevation to up, elevation to the top. That was once you got the spirit level set. Then there was a promising deck, which is movement and it's showing the body in the direction that you want to fire. And then you one shot, firing it, a base plate. The small one that fired was weighed about 2 pounds. The high explosive was about 2.5 pounds. And you could not fire it under 100 yards. You must be firing over 100 yards. The idea was the left arm was on the barrel. And then your chest on the breastplate, set the horizontal and elevation sights by swimming the barrel until you got the direction. And then, when you're ready, you pick the high explosive yourself, just reach over, remove the cover first, then pick the AT bomb, slip it in the barrel and push it with the air. Well, unfortunately, the time you did all these operations, the enemy had moved up in the whole regard to there. So, after the story of the I mentioned before, later, during my time in the services, we carried a 2-inch mortar all over India. It never fired a shot. The man who carried it, the bloke called Grumpy Armstrong, and the early part of the retreat out of Burma, that was when we were down in the Mongolia area, we come through the jungle on a high heat of skies, and the point showed that the last 30 days I'm carrying that, and all of it went, and that was the end, and we never had a 2-inch mortar in the platoon after that, because it may have been a similar issue in World War One, for any purpose that we need. I mean, we have the 3-inch mortars, which is battle. That was really all we needed, because this thing, it took so long to set. It was, I think that was called kind of the anti-tank rifle. Was about as much used as the Lee Enfield. But had no penetration power whatsoever. So I think Drunky had carried his hundreds and hundreds of thousands of miles. He finally got sick in about 1943 or 44 and disappeared. We heard a cry, and we just heard George, so he'll probably be lying now somewhere down among the area in Burma.
The boys' anti-tank rifle, you basically have, I think we said, it wasn't a great weapon. What did it look like? What was its characteristics?
Well, if you look at it first, it looked like the... Piper Bren with a two. We've had this long barrel with a muzzle loader. It weighed 35 pounds, carried a 0.55 shell, anything up to 500 yards, and it had a recoil reducer on the end, because where you put it in your shoulder, you had a big sponge, because the recoil and the kick was so much that it could break your shoulder. In fact, most people were trying to fight them, they were told about the recoil that much, but had a foresight and had the breech. If I remember correctly, the breech was like an ordinary rifle. So that was another thing we never found. Folks lugged them down and lugged them down. I did hear when I was in France that somebody had used one of these bikes. And they didn't even put a hole in where one of the German vehicles that you fired at. So, whether that was true or not, I don't know.
Was it still early days? You didn't have the Piat yet?
No, there was no Piat. That was the sole weapons. They were the sole weapons of the infantry tool, the Bren gun, the 2-inch mortar, and the boys' anti tank rifle. And of course, the rifleman and the unit. They were the sole weapons. On the 36 pounds in here, because the other one that came out later on was a Bakelite one, but that was later on when we got an order of that one. But they were still for strong guns.
Did you do any training in digging trenches? Or had we moved on a little bit from...
What was that?
Digging trenches. Did you dig trenches?
Trenches, yes. We used to get the spades and go out into the field and dig trenches, and then we also learned about wiring, which I have a note of here, rather funny enough, somewhere. Damn it, wiring. Double aprons between pickets. Pickets were 7'6" short pickets were 6 foot high.
And were these iron or steel pickets? Metal pickets, were they?
Metal pickets, yes. 9 coils of 95 yards were a 9-man load. So, 2 coils of 130 yards for 4 men. That was that Dunnett quantity, which was about the size of a lorry wheel. And just the cart road. And we used to go out and erect them. We could have done with a pair of grooves, like we could never got any grooves to put on.
Were there very thick and strong prongs on these, on the wires?
Yeah.
Barbs?
Yeah, the barbs. I think the barbs would be about probably about half to 3/4 of an inch long. The Dunnett concertina wire was easy enough to lay once you got a hold of the thing and it was just got pulled out. But just as well, we did learn about it, mate, because we did quite a lot of wiring later on. I think the film stood us in good stead at the end, mate. We thought it was a bit of a waste of time with some of the things we did, like, but at least when it came to doing the thing, you had a little bit of idea of what you were dealing with.
Did sniping come into your training at this point?
No, we were only told about it. I don't think there was enough crack shots in the house to do it. We never had any really wicked Sergeant York crack shots. We were told about sniping and how the people positions if you were designated to be a sniper.
Camouflage, was it part of your concealment?
Camouflage, yes.
How did you do that?
Well, we did self-camouflage, like the surroundings that you were in. If you were in grass, well, the grass used to be interwoven in the helmet and little bits stuck on the arm. There wasn't any black in my face, I don't think I thought about it then, mate, but that was curious, you just saw the ground rules of camouflage. Vehicle camouflage, we learned about it because each platoon was supposed to have its own little platoon truck, and we had camouflage netting that we used. Just to break the outlines of the truck that we had.
The hall that you were in, you were still sleeping on the floor, presumably.
Oh, yes.
And palliasses were there?
We moved on from palliasses. We moved on. We had biscuits, which I better describe, wasn't it? They were like a settee seat. I don't know what they were packed with, but the name that they got were biscuits. And you had three of those. But they were better to sleep on than palliasses, actually. And of course, the usual stock of, I think we had three blankets. No pillows. You used to use your pack for a pillow or your greatcoat. That's what you had for a pillow. And we just slept in a square, all the feet into the middle of the hall. Rifle laid down at the side. Upright position,
Inspections, we haven't touched upon kit inspections. Were you doing those?
We were learned how to fold the blankets. That was if you had two or three and the one blanket wrapped around the top. Kit inspections were, I think we had one or two. But it was only to make sure that you hadn't knobbled the equipment in. It was only to show you had hold all knife, fork, spoon, water bottle and everything, spare pair of boots. And as long as they were clean, there wasn't any that you see in the peacetime, nothing like that.
Did you lay it out in a specific way?
Just lay out on the bed, on the biscuits on the bed. The blankets were folded at the top. And your two towels, which was sent away to the laundry every week, with the PT kit. Because you have physical training, with a blue shorts and white t-shirt, or two white t-shirts, one to wear and one to wash out of it. And we'd receive the washing back every week, whenever it was done.
Was that an army charge? They paid for that?
Yes, the army paid for that.
Who did the inspections?
Was normally Sergeant O'Neill, but the officer that did the inspection was the officer who wrote, I think it's the book, The Billings of War, Lieutenant Rissick. He was the officer that we had.
What was he like?
Well, we didn't see a lot of him. He was a pleasant sort of chap. Helpful. If you wanted advice, you could go and see him. The officers didn't seem to get involved. Not the way I was to find out later on. Where you had your platoon officer later on. He sort of went in between the two different platoons, where it was only, as I said before, if there's any advice or if you wanted to know anything, he's quite available. You could see the sergeant and ask if he wanted it, if he could see the officer. And I remember him now, was it? I forgot all about it until I read that book, but that he wrote the Veterans of War. And he was the man at the time. I also knew in the other platoon was a Corporal Wilde, who I knew when I went to school. He was a bit older than me, but he joined the army when he left school. And he was a corporal in the other platoon that I was in the Bamford. Billy Wilde. If I wanted any information or anything, I used to go and see Billy, and he would just tell me, because I knew him particularly well. But I still had a veteran's call, or else I'd get me booted around it.
You could only approach the officer through your NCOs.
You know, they were always approachable. I'm not sure if you got the same. You could see either the corporal or the sergeant ask if you could see the officer. If he thought that there was something genuine, he could see the
These were still early days, and you weren't training with other units like artillery or tanks.
No, still infantry training. I've never seen a carrier, I've never seen a tank. All I've seen was Liam, 3999, that was.
Were you settling down well to what was a man's world? You know, there was no privacy.
I didn't have any problems that way. I began to realise after the first 2 weeks, make the best of a bad job, get out of it what you can. I think it was with all the gentlemen who had paid through it all himself. I realised, it's not such a good lot to be in line, but do what you can. You might get some good out of it. And I began to get used to that type of life. In fact, when I sort of came home, I used to come home on a weekend, the milk lorry, collecting all the milk, used to come through Bransford and Willingham. And we got a lift one morning and the bloke told us like that he came through this town. And often he used to jump on, legally of course, permission from the army, and jump on the milk wagon and get a lift as far as Horton Reach Spring, which is about 2 miles from Hetton, and then walk up home. And I was able to get home pretty often, you know, in the night time, and then get back by the bus, because it was easy to get into Durham and up to Greenland or Bransford. It was pretty easy to get a bus every quarter when I was still from Durham Station. So I was able to get home, quality troubles of the day, and get a good meal and get back and standing instead for the night of the day, which I think were pretty lucky, considering some groups who had been forced to different parts of the country. It wasn't a difficult place to get to and fro from. Really, I stopped coming home as much. At first, every opportunity I used to be on at home, and then I gradually was getting used to sort of army life. And the visits became less frequent, and mother and father wonder what was wrong that I wasn't coming home. And I said, well, I find now that my friends are either wounded or offensive. I began to lose touch with the people that I knew at home because I was in a different environment. They couldn't talk to me about what I was doing. I couldn't talk to them about their jobs. And I found that it was easier to hear. So I said, well, unless I'm really hungry, I'll not be home. So I think that was about Maybe the Sunday would be the only day I would be home to get a Sunday dinner that can go to your people. But the environment was altogether different to what I've been used to. And I was sort of slipping into the groove.
Team spirit was very important, was it? Team spirit, very important.
It's very important. That was the thing that was beginning to sing into me. As I say, I always keep referring to sport to me with the army. You play football, there are 11 of you playing together. You play cricket, there are 11 people playing together. You all got to pull your weight. I found out that when I was in a section, when we started doing route marches, you have a brain gun which was it 40 or 40 pounds or something like that. The weight happened to be here. It wasn't there we are. The whole gun weight was 45 and a half inches long. The barrel was 25 inches and the weight of the brain gun was 22 pounds. And there was a tripod that went with it, which weighed 25. Now in between these men you had to carry it. The bloke that was assigned the brain gun after he carried it for a few miles, he began to get tired. At first, there was a tendency of people to say, well, I'm not on the brain gun, I'm not carrying it. But later on I found there wasn't any question. It was passed down. And there was a bond start to develop amongst the people that you were with continuously. That you needed this guy's help and he needed yours. And that was something which I found developed in the army with me. That I've never met him civilian life. There was this point that you really need this bloke supporting him. And the more you did for him and the more he did for you, you rely on each other. And your life probably one day was going to depend on this. And this spirit developed slowly over the time. And I think with it being a local regiment, the language was the same. And there was something about it that you couldn't get in civilian life. And I think that's why I stopped this business of coming home regularly, because I used to find happier times with the people that I'm now being with.
Being in the army and war on, although you haven't yet experienced it, what was the claim of fighting for king and country in the scheme of things? Did you have this patriotic zeal?
Well, this is the thing that I turned over in my mind. All my life I've been interested in politics and one thing and another. I've always been greatly interested. This allegiance to king and country, although I'm a member of the services club, and one thing is on the Queen, I could never quite find out why I'm fighting for king and country. Nobody had ever said to me, you don't want to go and fight for king and country. They didn't say that. They told me that I'm going to leave home on the 15th of January and join the army. Well, I can't see in a democracy how I should have been detailed. If a democracy is a question of choice, if I hadn't gone, the only alternative was to be a conscientious objector, which never entered my mind. But I was never given a choice. I was never given a choice of what I wanted to do. I was never given a choice of the trade that I'd gone. I could have gone into the army and followed the trade. I wanted to join the Air Force voluntarily without being dragged in. I was never given a choice of that. It always rankled me. That's one thing that always rankled me. Why I didn't object that I knew I had to do something about it. I could never really accept this king and country business. I don't know why. I respect the Queen. I believe in the royal family, because if we didn't have him, we'd have a president, but it's one of the expensive things we've ever. But allegiance to the Queen. I gave my allegiance when I went in the army. I think by joining the army, you give allegiance to your country. But I would have liked to have had a choice. And yet that's the only thing that I ever objected to, that I was never given a choice. I was ordered. I think when you're ordered to do a thing, it's about saving a friend. Volunteer? Yes. I had volunteered to join the Air Force. But they said, no, you do what we want you to do. You join the Jeremiah Infantry, which I never regretted years after, but the point at the time was that why am I here? And I could never get an answer for myself as to why I was there.
Do you think that was the same attitude with most people?
I think it was. I think it was. And I honestly think a lot of people were frightened as to what would have happened if they said no. I was myself. I often wondered what would have happened if I'd said no. You hear these people who go in like with white feathers. But I always find that the people that do the shouting are the people that are not there. Two or three things bothered me about it, especially people who had been exempt. I have one friend who was early in the army. He was quick to point out, like, how he get out in the army. Purely and simply, was a joiner. How a joiner could be exempt, I don't know. But he got out somehow. So, whether friends in high places or some organization got him out. And he used to irritate me. In fact, he irritated me so much one night when I come back home on leave. But if the other two friends that were with me hadn't stopped me, I would have really done something that I've never done. That's even another person, I would have anger. This always rankled with me. If it was good enough for one, it was good enough for everybody. That was my opinion. Either that, or we should have had the choice. We should have had a choice of what we wanted to do. I know it's no good having 2 million votes in the Air Force and a couple of dozen in the Army that you've got to have. But I still think when a person volunteers, you should be given the option. All right, if you've got to call people up later on, if it's an act passed by the government, like it is the National Service. But we were dragged away from home. We had no option. Whether that the other people's eyes is democratic, it's not in mine. And that was the only thing that annoyed me, for all I got used to it.
Is your chief loyalty then to your immediate men, your section, platoon, and your regiment? Is that your main focus of loyalty?
My main loyalty was to the Jeremiah Infantry. I couldn't care about anything else. In fact, it became part of my life, I think. Still is. Still is part of my life, because one of the best parts of my life was spent with the Jeremiah Infantry. As I said before, I'm volunteered. I'll be happy, I'm back to your subject. Would I have been as happy? Would I have had as good times as that? Well, I'm saying good times. But would I have met as many good friends or as many good people or enjoy the same comradeship that I got in the Dynamite Embry, I don't know, because I never got in there. But the Dynamite Embry has been my life from the 15th of January 1940 up to the present day, and still part of it.